Broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University, this is WSDL Ocean City 90.7 FM. It's time now for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
In 1965, the March on Selma, Alabama, changed the face of American civil rights and with a clash that took place that shook the nation. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush, and this is part of the narrative of a short story entitled Iced Tea by Harold Wilson. He's president of the Eastern Shore Writers Association. The narrative involves Percy Moneyworth, who in that hot summer found himself in that southern town. And many years later, after a long career in the Justice Department, he reflects. Hal, welcome to the program, first of all.
Thank you very much.
You also mentioned, by the way, that he will also be guest hosting next week's Delmarva Today in a special writer's edition, and we'll be talking about that later in the program. First, I want to turn to the short story, and tell me then a little bit about what inspired you to write this story. And I guess we were just talking a bit before the program that there's actually two marches. So explain a little bit about how does the story form in your own mind?
Well, there are two incidents that form the basis of the story. The first incident is that back in the 1960s, I was very active in the civil rights movement. And the call went out to come to Selma for a memorial service for James Reeb, a Unitarian minister who had been working on civil rights with the Quakers in Boston, was killed. He was beaten to death in Selma on his way home from dinner one night with two companions. So the memorial service was set for the 15th of March, and I took a flight by myself down to Selma, and I joined a crowd there. And a lot of the feeling and the sense of what is going on with Percy Moneyworth is what I experienced. The other incident is I worked in Washington, D.C. for a number of years. And standing on K Street one day, I saw this elderly gentleman, hot August, bundled up, wearing everything in the world, and crossing, I think it was 17th Street, and a bus was trying to turn right. Its air conditioner was broken. Elbows were hanging. And he just was not moving very fast, and the bus was getting more and more exasperated. And I began to think, who is this guy? And where did he come from? How did he get on this corner? And who are the people on this bus? So that kicked around in my mind for probably 20 years. And finally, I sat down and I put the two together, Selma and 18th Street, 17th Street, in this short story.
So describe to me who Percy Pennyworth is, because as you seem to indicate, he's kind of removed, it seems to me, from certainly the conflict in the South, and there's a realization that takes place. Tell me a little bit about that.
Percy Moneyworth is based on a number of African-American friends that I had in New England. And Percy Moneyworth was from a small New Hampshire town. He's basically insulated from the deep racism of the inner city and of the South. And he got good grades, he grew up fine, went to law school, and was on his way up the corporate ladder, and becomes friends with James Reeb, and tells Reeb he's a civil rights movement, has nothing to do with him. He's going to be a corporate lawyer. And he goes to Selma, sent by his law firm, and he learns something about himself and about the civil rights movement.
Now, some of the most vivid scenes, of course, are in Selma itself. And I was also particularly struck by the angry white woman. I think she has a couple of children. And you make this observation about how she's not on the lowest rung of the society, but she very well could be. Describe that.
Yeah, well, the march There was a short march after the memorial service. The short march went from the courtyard at Brown Chapel to the Dallas County Courthouse. We're allowed to walk on the sidewalk with all of the local residents, the militia, the Forest Service, and the rest of the police on the other side of the street. And this woman that I describe in the short story is an example for me of all of the people on the other side of that street and earlier of the barrier who have hate in their eyes for this way of life that they see changing quite radically. And they're not dumb. They know that this is going to bring huge changes for them, and they hate it. And at the same time, this woman knows that she is, in fact, on the lower rung of the social ladder in Selma, and that, except for her white skin, she could be, as the story says, little more than kitchen help.
Now, what do you see as the connection between the people on the bus in the years later as opposed to the people who were out there? Because you seem to indicate that despite all the changes that have occurred, there is still this racism still out there.
Well, that's exactly right. And from my perspective, that racism, and this is Washington, D.C. now, that racism is buried pretty deep. But it doesn't take very much to bring it to the surface. And a hot day and being inconvenienced by, again, a black person on the lower rung of society's ladder, totally inconvenienced and made uncomfortable, can unearth those feelings in white people that are still there, I believe.
So when he comes home and he makes the observation about iced tea, and which is the name of the story, and the concept of revenge, and you say basically effect that it may be, you know, bitter afterwards, but there's a sweetness to it. What do you mean by that?
It's interesting that when Percy Moneyworth walks in the door, Clodagh, his wife, says to him, she looks at the overcoat over his arm. She said, "You've been out messing with those buses again, haven't you?" So this is obviously not the first time. Percy has a plan. And he has been, he says, an inconvenience to the white world as a lawyer at the Justice Department for years. Now he has decided that he's retired to be a personal inconvenience. And he makes the observation, which I think is excellent, that any significant change is an inconvenience to someone. But Percy is a human being, and he likes a little taste of revenge as well after all of these years. And so he's quite comfortable with making these people uncomfortable and being an inconvenience. And then, of course, as you'll hear in the story, the iced tea is the symbol of that.
And by the way, now, and he's also, I guess his wife makes reference to that they're supposed to go to some kind of ceremony. Is that right?
Yeah, well, there is a retirement party, even though it isn't explicitly stated in the story. It's intimated that there is some kind of a celebration for Percy going on at the State Department. I mean, he has not been a minion there. He has been a force in the State Department, and not the State Department, but in the legal division of the Justice Department. And so there is a car. Janet Reno, this is the period, Janet Reno is sending a car to pick them up. And that's the indication that he's somewhat an important person, that a car is coming to get them, to take them to the Justice Department for their little ceremony.
One final thing before we go to it, and we should also inform our listeners that during this story, the N-word, by the way, is used. And I was kind of curious about why you felt that was that word particularly was important to you. So it only shows up once, but it was important to you.
Yeah, it was important to me because it it is an expression of the exasperation of one of the people on the bus. And he, clearly the word is out of use, but he cannot contain himself. And the psychological racism is so deep within him that that word just comes out. And it is a way not simply of identifying Percy Moneyworth, but it is a way this bus rider identifies himself.
So let's go ahead and listen to this story. It lasts about 15 minutes, and then we'll come back and talk about next week.
Super. It is August 2001, Washington, D.C., and it is hot, over 100 degrees. Percy Moneyworth is shuffling down K Street, bulked up in a dark green sweater, a ratty brown overcoat that hangs below his knees, and a knit cap pulled down to his eyebrows. Hunched over three bags of groceries, he approaches a small knot of pedestrians waiting to cross the intersection at 18th Street. It is 5:30 Friday evening, and the office buildings are pouring their human contents onto the sidewalk. The light changes, and the clot of white shirts and bare arms morphs into a fine stream that flows across the intersection. Alone in his bundledness, Percy moves forward as well, flotsam pulled along by the current of pedestrians. A commuter bus turning right from the access lane onto 18th Street pauses to let the human stream pass. White elbows and rolled up white sleeves poke from the windows of the bus. A stroke of luck, Percy thinks. The air conditioner is broken. Hot. It was also hot that day in Selma, Alabama, March 15, 1965. There was no breeze in the courtyard before Brown Chapel and no air conditioning in the car that brought Percy to Selma from the Montgomery Airport. Two young men, anonymous soldiers in Martin Luther King's struggle for voter rights, had met Percy in the terminal and led him to a battered Chevrolet for the ride to the front lines. The road slid black beneath them. The car not moving, it was the earth that turned, bringing Selma to Percy. Back in the 18th and K Street intersection now, the asphalt is soft under Percy's feet. The air in radiant waves lifts from its black surface. The bus waits for Percy to clear its path. Impatient, it angles forward until Percy is framed in its monstrous windscreen. There is a light tap on the horn. From the windows, white faces peer at Percy. Percy shuffles forward, stops, and struggles to keep his three bags of groceries from sliding from his grip. Hunched over, hugging the bags to his chest, the middle bag slips down to rest on his thighs. He crouches to keep it from dropping to the hot pavement. But the pull of the earth is winning, and the bag slides until arrested between his bent knees. The bus continues to creep up on Percy, its horn now an irritated blast. In Selma, Percy pushed into the crowd gathered before the church and worked his way to the far perimeter. Arrested by a wooden traffic barrier, he faced a throng of troopers, local police, sheriff's deputies, and possemen, a microcosm of white Alabama manhood. Middle-aged and pot-bellied, young and wiry, limp-spined and slack-lipped, all showing a lazy, self-confident aggression. The flimsy traffic barrier and no more than 3 feet separated them from Percy. "What's the matter, Yankee boy?" The voice came from a small man in a green uniform that said, "Forest Service." "You, Yankee boy. I mean you in the suit." And Percy realized he was the only person on either side of the barrier in a three-piece suit. He returned the man's gaze and refused to look away. "You done stepped in it now, huh?" the green shirt said. And the man softly caressed his billy club with the palm of his open hand in an obscene gesture of power. Back in the 18th Street intersection now, Percy is crouched down, his overcoat pooled around his feet. The bus inches forward, threatening. Then, through a small tear in the bottom of the middle sack, three cans of tomato paste slip to the roadway. The cans scatter. Percy stretches for them. Arms extended from the bus windows are threatening now. The faces are no longer white. They are red with angry blood. From the middle of the bus, a voice yells, "Get out of the way, you black bastard." And from closer to the front, "Move it, nigger. Jesus Christ." The sting of the word said Selma again, and Percy couldn't move. It wasn't the wooden barrier that held him that Selma day. It wasn't the crowd pressed at his back. Percy could feel a line, an invisible line, drawn behind him in the crowded dirt yard of Brown Chapel. It encompassed Selma. It comprehended all of the Deep South. It circumscribed his future. This is not the battle Percy would have chosen. Free of serious racial conflict, his had been a privileged life, a well-off childhood in small-town New Hampshire, a good student at Boston University, headed for a partnership with a first-rate Boston law firm. It had been smooth sailing for Percy Moneyworth. Others can carry the burden of equality. Percy was too busy. He did make it a point to meet and get to know Reverend James Reeb, as well as the Berrigan brothers and William Sloan Coffin. He figured these guys were going to need lawyers for sure, and he wanted to be in the queue. It was a senior partner who called Percy into his office to tell him that his friend, the Unitarian minister, was dead. "Clubbed to death in Selma just last night," he said. Percy was stunned. His breath came short and hot. "There's going to be a memorial service," the senior partner said. "You should go. Might even make some good contacts." Now in the 18th Street intersection, Percy is reaching for his groceries. His hand searches for the tomato paste. Sweat is rolling down his face in great streaks. His breath is coming short. A woman in a business suit retrieves the three cans and places them in Percy's bag. "Are you all right?" she says. Her voice is gentle. In Selma, the voices at the memorial service were clear and ringing. They called for the world to take notice, to be counted. Percy, seated in the center balcony, looked down on the chancel. At the center pulpit, Dr. King has said who killed James Reeb, and now turned to what killed him. Percy was intent as Dr. King went down his list of the what. Then, "Yes," he said, "he was even murdered by the cowardice of every Negro who tacitly accepts the evil system of segregation, who stands on the sidelines in the midst of a mighty struggle for justice." If someone had reached across at that moment and slapped Percy Moneyworth, he would not have been more shocked. The words cut him to the quick, and Percy now understood the line drawn behind him at the barricade. His past, the indifference he brought to Selma, was forever closed to him. Then, Form 3 abreast, the congregation was at the traffic barrier, ready for the march to the Dallas County Courthouse. The yellow barricade opened and the marchers moved on to Sylvan Street. It was only a few blocks to the courthouse, but for Percy it was like crossing the Great Divide. They marched on the sidewalk. A wall of people gathered on their left, threatening silently. A great muttering of feet pushing forward on the pavement was the only sound. A blur were the onlookers. Only one woman caught Percy's eye. Standing in the front row, a limp cotton dress without shape hung from her shoulders. A boy and a girl pulled at her arms on either side. It was clear that the woman was dirt poor and worked to the bone. Clear that the man behind her with a beefy arm on her shoulder used her badly. The woman followed Percy with a look of hatred he had never felt before. As sharp as scissors, her eyes snipped him out of the line of marchers and laid on him the blame for everything that was wrong about her life. Everything. As he stared back, the woman's look of accusation crumbled to something of despair. In that despair, Percy saw her realization that if not for her white skin, she herself would be counted as little more than Selma's kitchen help. The light in the 18th and K Street intersection has changed again, and the sidewalk is crowded. Percy shuffles to a corner building. He stuffs his knit cap into his overcoat pocket and retrieves two folded tote bags. He transfers the groceries to the bags, takes off his overcoat and sweater, and lays them over his arm. In a short-sleeved blue shirt with an open collar, he takes up the totes and walks briskly down K Street. At Luther Place, he gives a nod over his left shoulder to Martin Luther, forever on his pedestal. Then at a wrought iron gate, he lets himself into a small yard and onto a brick walk that leads to his front door. The walk is lined with a thick growth of knockout roses, wearied by the heat, but still in bloom. Percy lets himself into the foyer. "That you, Percy?" calls a fine soprano voice from the kitchen. Then a face peers around the corner of the doorway. The woman smiles at the sight of the two totes of groceries, then frowns at the sweater and overcoat. "You've been out messing with those buses again, Percy." "Just causing a little inconvenience, Clodie, that's all. A little inconvenience." "Making a nuisance of yourself, I'd say. Bring those things in here." And shaking her head, "It was a long time ago, Percy. Come take some tea." "Nuisance. Well, that'll do, but I like inconvenience better. A necessary inconvenience." "Necessary, Clodie, because those Europeans would have died off without us. We plowed, planted, lifted, toted, harvested, built up, tore down, delivered, all in the hot sun. Strong. We were strong while they grew weak and died like flies from the disease. Inconvenient. Because we were a vexation. Bartered us like animals, but we had our ways of standing up." "Percy, stop prattling. We're due at Justice at 8. They're sending a car." "The system was rotten, Clodie. Had to be wrenched around. Wrenching. That's always inconvenient for somebody." Percy takes the iced tea from the counter. "Talking to the kitchen now." "That's right. An official inconvenience for 25 years of civil rights law at Justice. And now retired, I've decided to be a personal inconvenience. expose the bad apples in the barrel, or at least on the bus, raising the glass of iced tea, toasting the kitchen. Percy Moneyworth, personal nuisance, he says. And after a long drink, you know, Clodie, getting even is like this iced tea here. It's bound to leave a bitter aftertaste, but it sure is sweet going down.
That, of course, is a story by Harold Wilson, who is also in our studio. He is, of course, president of the Eastern Shore Writers Association. Let me ask one final question about all this. Given we've obviously elected the first African-American president, and the fact that despite all of the progress that seems to be moving forward, we still see racial overtones in protests and how people comment on them. What's your feeling about where we are now as opposed to back when in the 60s?
I think clearly there have been very, very significant changes. However, like Percy Moneyworth crossing 18th Street in front of the bus, there are still people who, if you dig down deep enough, have the same racial animosity in their makeup that we had during the Civil Rights Movement. And I believe that this president, the first black president, has in fact stirred that animosity. And again, there is a small group of people in this country who cannot abide the fact that an African American is the leader of the greatest nation in the world. And as a result of his skin color, as a result also of his politics and his policies, again, like the people on the bus, there emerges from them this racial animosity that has probably laid dormant for a number of years.
Do you think it's just almost merely, I mean, his mere presence that this change has occurred? I mean, irrespective, because you mentioned a moment ago about policies, but just because I know from public opinion polls during the first election, the 2008, there were people who said they couldn't vote for somebody who was African American. I mean, it seems it's still there, although I guess by...
Don, I think you're right. I think it is very much still there, and I think it is influencing their attitude toward his policies as well.
Mm-hmm. I want to turn now to next week's show, which you will be guest hosting. We're going to call it the Writer's Edition. And you're going to be talking about memoirs. Tell me a little bit about the idea behind the show.
Oh, well, I think this is going to be a very exciting show. We're going to talk to Laura Oliver about memoir. And what is behind that is basically that everyone has a good story to tell about their life, or a number of good stories. And memoir is incredibly popular right now, both among writers and among readers. And so we thought that we would discuss memoir with the listeners. And there are some kind of interesting approaches. Laura Oliver, of course, is a well-published author. She teaches at St. John's College, and she teaches at the Writers Center also in Washington. So we're going to look at what a memoir is. How does a memoir differ from an autobiography, for instance? And there are some interesting and significant differences. We're going to look at memoir in the sense of, do you always have to tell the truth?
I'm going to leave it right there, and then we'll hear whether or not you indeed have to on the next show. We've been talking with Harold Wilson. He is president of the Eastern Shore Writers Association, also guest hosting next Delmar for Today, the Writers Edition, talking about memoir. This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush, and thanks for listening.
Delmarva Today is a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Don Rush is the host. Cora Mitchell is our volunteer producer. Chris Rank is the executive producer and audio engineer. You can listen to this program again on our website, delmarvapublicradio.net. You can also view our program on PAC-14 television and on demand. Visit PAC-14.org for full details and schedules.